by chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you see it coming, no time to beg out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, there'll be no doubt when you see you are. Grass make dab in the middle of it. Grass make dab in the middle. We are grass make dab.
Secret truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. We're going to reach back into the past and do a rebroadcast of an hour that I had on another program called World Review Commentary, broadcast on We the People Radio Network. And anyway, my guest at that time was Paul Craig Roberts. And the reason why I'm running this is it's very prophetic what he was saying about the economic and financial problems that we're facing. And also we addressed some questions with China and so forth. We covered derivatives. We covered the offshore production. There's just a lot of different aspects here that Paul Craig Roberts was actually able to bring onto the program, and he explained it so well. We got into central banking. We talked about some of the money centers of the world, about the city of London being and continuing to be the money center, you could say, in the world. And so this program, in my way of thinking, is sort of It was a prophetic and a prophecy almost for what President Trump is beginning to do now. And we need to bring more production back from the offshore production back to America to solve our jobs problem. But in doing that also, because when you're producing offshore like that and you're buying the product from offshore and from overseas, you're depleting and transferring your assets as an asset transfer. And Paul Craig Roberts goes into that also. There's a transfer of our assets to some of these foreign entities because they're building up credits against our imports. We've been running tremendous trade deficits for decades now. And so the problem with America is that we're building up a debt. And in fact, I broached the question with him, to Paul Craig Roberts, are we going to, is America headed towards a debt slavery? See, now, George W. Bush had $10 trillion in debt when he went out of office. Now we've got $21 trillion in debt. And so we are headed, we're not headed there, we're already in a debt slavery already. And the question at the beginning of this program, and of course, this is a rebroadcast. I couldn't ask him the question tonight. But if I were to have him back on the program, my question would be to him is that, is America already doomed for this debt? Can we ever repay this debt or not? There's a concept called odious debt. And odious debt is debt that has been created unconstitutionally, okay, by a nation state. I think when Khomeini took power in Iran, he refuted some debt that was owed to Western banks, okay? And on the basis that this was odious debt, it was created under the Shah, but the Shah didn't, the process of creating that debt, even under the Shah's government, with the Shah's constitutional processes at that time were not followed. So, Khomeini declared that debt to be odious debt. And this is actually what gave rise to this big confrontation with Iran at the time, the taking of the hostages and so forth. So, and eventually at the end, if you'll remember, they started transferring international credits and stuff through their bank in Tripoli, I think it was, through the Bank of England, Bank of Tripoli and all this. And so that gave you a good insight into international finance right there. Basically, when Iran took our hostages under the Jimmy Carter administration, then we froze all the accounts that Iran had worldwide, basically, and began to offset, try to recover our loan from those frozen accounts. In the end, we finally recovered most of it, and it took a long time before Iran was released back all the frozen funds, you know. So this international finance, there's power of money, and the money power is very great. We have created a society and a pecking order that's money dominated, and it's top down is the money and what you're worth and what your net worth and all this is that people are looking at now. So we have created a system of mammon. Charlotte and I touched on that during this first hour earlier this evening. But Paul Craig Roberts has quite a mind. He was an economist, advisor to President Reagan. He's accused of this trickle-down thing. The economy under Reagan was good, hopefully, and it looks like that President Trump, is turning things around now, and we're beginning to, America's responding to that turnaround. And it looks like we're going to have a rising economy here. And hopefully we're going to be producing. We need more small businesses again out there. I've noticed driving out through the, highways and byways of Central Texas that there's these little metal buildings. They might, when I say little, they're not that small some. But they might be 5, 10, 15, 20,000 square foot buildings that are like machine shops, and they're building electrical devices and monitoring devices, detection devices, security devices. And I see that scattered out throughout Central Texas. So if we can get back to inventing things, we have a great reservoir of great minds in this country that can invent things and create new products and new inventions. And we certainly have had a tremendous web and internet production and increase in services and stuff coming right out of America. So we must continue that and provide goods and services where Amazon and all this is going on also. There's still a need for people to go into shops, whatever size they might be, to see the product themselves. They can buy it and take it back and exchange it for something that fits better or whatever, could be a problem. Right then and there, there are people that still like a hands-on type of situation versus, ordering it through by internet or whatever. The internet is coming in, and the retail is taking over much of your general retail market at this time. But it's not going to be all of the retail business. There'll still be retail businesses out here doing business. I want to set this up again. Paul Craig Roberts. It's a rebroadcast from right before right at the beginning of this financial debacle problem in 2007. We recorded this and broadcast it on August 19th, 2007. And so this is prophetic. And so listen carefully to what Paul Craig Roberts has to say, and then take that and compare it to what President Trump is beginning to do. President Trump is revitalizing this country. He's allowing corporations to bring back, repatriate a lot of capital back with very minimal types of penalties. He's lowering the tax rate on individuals. And CBS compared two tax returns, and both those individuals in the $70,000 to $100,000 a year bracket, both of those tax returns and those individuals are experiencing a greater net income and a lower tax rate. So this thing that the Democrats are putting forward, it's a big mistake for them to be criticizing to the degree that they have been about this tax cut and reform not benefiting the average person. It will. The first 24,000 of a married couple, no taxes will be paid. So anyway, want to thank you. Come into the Secret Truth and listen to this on an on-demand basis. And I want to thank each and every one of our listening audience out there. I want to wish them, Charlotte Littlefield Brown and I, George Butler, wish everyone in our listening audience and all of our friends and associates a happy new year. And boy, we wish you the best luck ever. And we're going to get down here and rebuild America again. And we can do it with hard work and a lot of roll up those sleeves, fella. We're going to do it. Thank you for listening. Good night.
We have today a fine individual. He's been out there writing and working really overnight, 24 hours a day for years. His name is Paul Craig Roberts. He's an economist and a nationally syndicated columnist for Creator Syndicate. He served as Assistant Secretary of the Treasury in the Reagan administration, earning fame as the father of Reaganomics. He is a former editor and columnist for the Wall Street Journal, Business Week, and Scripps Howard News Service. He's a graduate of the Georgia Institute of Technology, holds a Ph.D. from the University of Virginia. He was a postgraduate at the University of California, Berkeley, and Oxford University, where he's a member of Merton College. In 1992, he received the Warren Brooks Award for Excellence in Journalism. In 1993, the Forbes Media Guide ranked him as one of the top seven journalists in the United States. Welcome, Paul Craig Roberts, to our program.
Thank you.
I tell you, I have a click-off on my page there, worldreview.tv, that they can read more about your many accomplishments. And you really have done a great service to this country. Right now, in this, you wrote an article recently about China. Could you sort of relate that to our listeners a little bit?
The Chinese get blamed in the United States for the trade deficit that we're running with them, and for all the Chinese goods that are on shelves of stores that we buy. And I pointed out that actually the Chinese aren't to blame. It's the offshoring of U.S. production for U.S. markets. The American firms increasingly don't produce the goods they sell us with American labor here in the United States. Instead, they relocate their production of goods and also services offshore, where labor costs are so much lower and also regulatory costs are lower, just general harassment costs are lower, and bring the goods back in. So when they do that, it turns what was domestic gross national product into imports. And so every time an American firm offshores its production, it increases our trade deficit. So I pointed out that's the real cause of the trouble. It's not China. It'd be unreasonable to expect them to close their borders to to foreign capital and technology. Now, once this problem has showed up, the pressure out of the American political system has been on China to raise its the value of its currency, and so that it takes the dollar buys fewer units of the Chinese currency. The belief is that this would cause the trade balance to rectify. It would have to be a huge reevaluation in order to offset the much lower cost. And one of the direct consequences of such a reevaluation would be that when Americans go into Walmart, where 70% of the goods are said to be from China, when they enter Walmart to make the purchases after such a revaluation is being urged on China, they would think they were in Neiman Marcus or Tiffany's or something. The prices would be so high. So when you become dependent on imports from a foreign country, and they're really not imports in a classic sense, they're the offshore production of American firms, and you raise the prices, it's the same thing as the American firms just raising their prices 30% or 50% or whatever it would take. And so since it's not American incomes that are going up, but the prices that Americans pay, everyone would take a very serious reduction in their real incomes. So that's the second part, and there's just one more part. I know I'm
okay. Go ahead. Go ahead. Yeah,
I'm talking too much. But
you're hitting on some good points here. Go ahead. Just speak. All right. Speak your mind.
The third point is that China has pegged its currency to the dollar, and I think they did this in order that currency speculators couldn't derail their own investment plans. And the United States then has been putting pressure on China to revalue its currency, and they've been doing it publicly so that if China were to accede to the pressure from the United States, it would look like they were essentially our lackey and they would lose face. And so recently, after the Treasury Secretary Paulson was over in China giving them orders, they simply announced in the way they do that it wasn't very nice of the Americans to be over there ordering around their bankers, because China is our biggest banker, and China said, you know, if we were to revalue our currency, then our tremendous holdings of dollars would be devalued by that same amount. You're asking us to devalue our $1.3 trillion in dollar assets by 30%. That's a huge hit. We would probably have to sell dollars because, you know, we wouldn't want to hold all these things that you want us to make worth less. And, of course, if we were to sell the dollars, then you wouldn't be able to finance your deficits or your wars, and your interest rates would go up. And so they just pointed this out. And so everyone over here went berserk. Oh, the Chinese threat, blah, blah, blah. Well, it just kind of shows the one-sided way Americans look at things. They think everybody's supposed to do what we say, and with no regard to their own interest. And if they don't, we demonize them and bomb them or invade them, or we find some way to try to punish them. And I think what China has shown here is that as far as China goes, all that's over. We're not capable of bullying them anymore because they hold the cards. They can destroy us financially any minute they want to. And when they made this clear, you saw all the markets start falling all over the world. And people have blamed this on the subprime mortgage derivatives, and I'm sure that's played a part. But the reason is that everyone realized that the Americans were being stupid, bullying their own banker. And if the Chinese turn loose of these dollar-denominated assets that they hold, those dollars in those subprime mortgage instruments that are all over the world would really be under pressure. So people started getting out of them as best they could. So this was all brought on, in my view. I mean, the instruments are unsound. There's no doubt about it. But that particular crisis that we've been through last week, we don't know if it's over, it may be, may not be, was, in my view, brought on by this public bullying of China, which finally resulted in a Chinese public response. And that just goes to show how hubris-filled Americans are, their government, how hubris-filled the government that it thinks it can just go around bullying people without any consequence.
Is that sort of anathema, this hubris type of attitude to the male ego or not?
I don't know. I think females have egos too. I think on the whole what it is, George, it's the product of the post-World War II era, because World War II destroyed everybody but us. You know, every other industrial country was decimated, and they couldn't produce anything. And even the Soviet Union was decimated. I mean, their victory over Germany was paid for, you know, many times. So here was the United States, only country that could produce anything. And the British pound, which had been the world reserve currency, more or less, was completely wiped out. So the dollar inherited the role of reserve currency, and the United States was the only country that could make anything because everybody else's capacity was destroyed in the war. So we were sitting beside the world like a colossus. Only we had goods, and we and the dollar was the reserve currency. Now, when you're the reserve currency, what it means is that you can pay your own bills, no matter how big the deficits, in your own currency. And no other country can really do that, because every other central bank uses your currency as if it were gold reserves, because the dollar was the currency used to settle international accounts, so everybody could pay their energy bills, they could settle their own balance of payment deficits or whatever. So that gave us more than a half a century of ability to be financially irresponsible. We could run as many deficits, trade deficits, budget deficits, as we wanted, because people would accept the dollars in payment. Now, Brazil can't do that, and Argentina can't do that. Do you see what I'm saying? Because their currency doesn't have that role, and people know that they're consuming, if they do that, they're consuming more than they can pay for, and that they're not going to get paid.
Well, was one of the reasons why the U.S. currency became a world reserve currency was because of oil sales were dominated in the U.S. dollar?
Well, that only happened, Bo, because the British pound was destroyed by two world wars. I mean, the British used to dominate the Middle East. And because the United States was the sole intact economy of any size, you know, after World War II. So that's why everything was denominated. The fact that they weren't, the oil was denominated in dollars, was just a reflection of the fact that we were the reserve currency. We didn't become the reserve currency because of that. But once we became reserve currency for the two reasons I gave you, you know, the British pound was dethroned and we had the industrial capacity. So because we were the reserve currency, they denominated oil sales. Now, people think today, oh, well, if some oil-producing country didn't use dollars but use euros, that it would dethrone the dollar. Well, that's not true. And what will dethrone the dollar is there has to be some alternative reserve currency. And at the moment, it's not clear there is one. People are trying to get out of dollars, and because they're trying to get out of them, the dollar value has been declining relative to the euro, the British pound, the Canadian dollar. What few currencies that exist that are traded on currency exchanges, but other than for the euro, those economies aren't very big. There's not much room for dollars to go flooding into them. And so it sort of kept the dollar higher, because people can't really split very easily.
They're sort of locked into the dollar because they're holding a lot of, securities and investments.
But there's nowhere to go.
That's right. They're locked into the dollar. So if they all start dumping, then their assets start suffering, right, in value.
Right. But, you see, if they just, as long as we're running the kind of deficits that we run, suppose they just stop buying less of our new bond issues. They may hold what they've got. They may still be buying treasury bonds every time we issue new ones, but they may buy less. So that leaves, you know, a surplus there. And the fact that people are trying to diversify their foreign exchange holdings away from the dollar means that the value of the dollar has been falling. It's fallen about 30% just over the last few years. So this is a tremendous change. But it hasn't fallen that much relative to the Chinese currency because they have pegged it to the dollar. The Chinese have not let enough of their currency out such that it can be successfully traded in foreign exchange markets. So there you have the picture.
Boy, that's a good beginning, a good foundation for us to build from. We're going to be back in about 3 minutes. So hang in there, and you're putting out some really fine information for our listeners. We'll be back in about 3 minutes. Thank you very much. The World Review Commentary. This morning we have Paul Craig Roberts. Welcome back, Mr. Roberts, Dr. Roberts.
Thank you, George. Thank you.
You really laid out some fine foundation for us to work from. I have one question for you about this Chinese situation. What are some solutions for the United States in dealing with this big, foreign reserves of over $1.2 trillion and $9 billion in U.S. securities? What can would domestic consumption within China alleviate some of that?
No, it wouldn't reduce their holdings. You see, look, as long as the United States is offshoring the production of goods and services that are sold to Americans, and China is a major recipient of the offshore production, then they will continue to run large trade surpluses with the United States. Once again, it's not really trade that's going on. It's just American. It's not that our firms are trading against Chinese firms and that they're underselling us. That's not what's really happening. What's happening is the American firms are just moving their plant and equipment to China and hiring Chinese labor to produce the same goods that they used to produce with American labor. So as long as that's going on, China is going to have these large surpluses. That means at the end of each year, they're going to have far more dollars that we have spent for goods made in China, if only by American companies. They're going to have many more of their dollars than we're going to have claims on them for what we sold to them. And so their holdings of dollars increase each year. And the question is, are they willing, how long are they willing for that to go on? And if they decide at the end of the year, well, we've got another $200 billion and we've already got $1.3 trillion, so what are we going to do with them? They decide that, well, let's trade them for euros or Japanese yen or Thai baht or Canadian dollars, or then that puts more pressure down on the dollar. So what could be done about it? as long as the American firms only have two interests, and that is shareholder return and bonus compensation packages for the chief executives. They'll continue to offshore because every time they lower the cost, the profits are up, so the shareholder returns are up, and then the executives in the corporation can pay themselves huge bonuses for increasing the profits. So as long as American management does not have any sense of country or any sense of America, but only the sense of their own pocketbook, the offshoring would continue unless some sort of tariff was put on to equalize the labor costs in the countries. But you see, you'd have a hard time getting such a tariff passed because it would be against the interest of the corporations, because it's their goods that are coming in from China. So as long as the offshoring is the wave of the future, the Chinese holdings of dollars will just rise, and then they'll have to decide if they're willing to hold them or if they're not. Now, another source, George, of the difficulty is the American budget deficits. Washington runs large budget deficits. That means the government cannot pay its bills based on tax revenues. And so what it does to cover the difference is it issues United States Treasury bonds and bills. And since the savings rate in the United States is pretty close to zero, it's not Americans who are buying the Treasury debt that's issued to pay the government's bill. It's foreigners. And it's always, or most of the time, it's foreigners who have trade surpluses with us because they have the excess dollars, and what they do with them, they just put them into the Treasury bonds because that pays interest. And holding dollars doesn't. So China, then, for example, China uses the surplus dollars they get from all the offshoring of American production to finance the budget deficit of the United States. And so, if, for example, our wars now against Iraq and Afghanistan and whoever they're going to invade next, these wars are financed by the willingness of the Chinese and the Japanese to purchase the Treasury debt that pays for the wars. So, at some point, when China and Japan find that these wars are interfering with their energy supplies, which they'll certainly do if we attack Iran, like Cheney keeps saying we must do, they may decide they're not going to finance our wars. They may decide the United States is just an insane, dangerous place and has to be closed down. And they can do it just by not financing us. They don't really even have to dump the existing holdings. If they decide not to buy any more plus dump, you know, to use a somewhat crude expression, they have us by the short hairs. And how much provoking it would take to make them exercise the power they have, I don't know. The world just kind of gets used to American, you know, like we're the heavyweight boxing champ and nobody really wants to take us on. And people just kind of kowtow and go along and do what we tell them. But at some point, people will figure out, well, you know, they're really not such a superpower after all. They can't even finance their own government. They're dependent on us to finance the war. The dollars are everywhere. Nobody wants the blasted things. There's too many of them, and therefore the value of them has declined. Already foreigners own so much of our assets and have such a huge stake in federal debt that they just may figure that It's not the thing to do anymore. And you just can't tell, George, how people come to these decisions, what might bring them to these decisions. A lot of people say, oh, they don't have any choice because they hold so many dollars. If they did anything, they would lose the value. But they're already losing the value. You know, the dollar's already down 30%.
Well, is the technique to unwind a bad position over a period of time whenever you have made a bad investment, try to do it over a period of time so that your assets diminish at a minimum rate?
Well, you see, one country could do that, but they can't all do it.
I see. It's humongous.
If China wanted to do that and everybody was willing to buy what they're selling.
I see.
But if everybody's trying, if everybody who's got these excess dollar holdings wants to do it, there's nowhere for it to go except
there's no buyers in
here. Down.
I got you. Have we been living on borrowed money for a number of years, America?
Oh, yeah.
Our standard of living then has been really established artificially high on this borrowed money system. Is that right?
It's established on the dollar being the reserve currency.
And that means that the other countries are taking dollar-denominated securities. They're buying, they're taking the dollars and converting those into securities and holding those, right?
Yeah, right.
And then that means that we're able to continue to borrow at, more and more.
Yeah.
Our debt is increased. Yeah.
If we were not the reserve currency, George, they wouldn't be willing to do this.
I see. But because we have been, then they're willing to take those dollars in the form of securities and sit on them and get an interest rate return.
Right.
We're going to be back in about 3 minutes. Hang in there. This is getting good now, okay?
Hey, Jack.
Welcome back to World Review Commentary. We have with us this morning Paul Craig Roberts. Welcome back, Paul Craig Roberts.
Thank you, George.
I had a question here for you about, we always talk about us against them. How about things like, there was a recent investment in Blackstone Group of $3 billion by this Chinese group. Would that bring us into more of an internationalist view by looking at it a little differently?
Well, George, that's just normal foreign investment. We buy, or we used to when we had trade surpluses, buy assets of other countries, and now they buy ours because we pour out so many dollars. And it's, you know, the Chinese can decide, well, do we want to buy any more treasury bonds, or we'd rather buy into some investment company that might make money, that might shield us in part from the decline in the value of the dollar. So that's an effort, I think, on the part of the Chinese to reallocate their dollar holdings from treasury debt into equities. And it makes sense. It makes sense for them. $3 billion, of course, is a minute amount. It doesn't amount to anything when we're running $200 to $300 billion annual deficits with them. So we're talking about, you know, 1% of 1 year's excess dollars that China ends up with. So it's not any big thing. It's just them looking at their portfolio and saying, well, we've got too much in American debt, and we ought to buy more companies. You know, like they bought IBM's personal computer business a year or two ago. We should either buy more companies or we should buy into the investment.
Are they going to end up owning a good portion of our assets?
Foreigners already own a good portion of our assets. When I was the Assistant Secretary of the Treasury of the United States, had a net earnings from its holding of foreign assets compared to what we had to pay out to foreigners who owned our assets. We to put it this way, we had a profit on the situation. Today, it's the opposite. They're paid more from their holdings of our assets, then we're paid from our holdings of their assets, which is another thing that adds to the overall deficit in the balance of payments that we run. So that's how a country, George, is only one way a country in these days and times can pay when it consumes more than it produces. You see, we're running now over an $800 billion annual trade deficit. That means we are Americans are consuming, you know, close to $1 trillion worth of goods and services every year, more than Americans produce. So how do you pay for that? Well, you pay for it essentially by turning over your assets. It's called eating the seed corn. American real estate, American companies, equities, and treasury bonds that used to be bought by Americans when they had a positive savings rate are now all acquired by foreigners. So that's how you pay for it when you consume more than you produce, which America has been doing for some time now, almost ever since I left the Treasury, almost a quarter of a century.
In the past, and right now still, London is still a financial center. Will it remain that way in the future? I see that that Barclays was seeking two partners recently. One was the Chinese group, and another partner was a Singapore group to take over, I believe, the ING company, the banking company out of the Netherlands. Is London still willing and dealing on an international basis, and will it remain that way?
Yes, I think London is just a center where the financial transactions are made. It's where investment bankers find ways to finance the debt of companies, takeovers, buyouts, and their skills there in doing that. And so that activity will remain there, just like it is in New York.
Is it true that go ahead. Excuse me. I'm sorry.
Okay, George. It doesn't mean, though, that it's all done with British money or American money. The capitalization of these investment banking activities could come from anywhere. And as the Chinese are so flush with U.S. dollars because of the offshored American production, then they're a good source of liquidity for these financial centers like London and New York.
Is it true that the Bank of England had no need to inject funds into their system recently?
I don't know, George. I couldn't answer that.
That was reported out of I believe, Financial Times, but I don't have total verification. But Financial Times there was reporting that earlier last week that the Bank of England, at the time that the article had been written, had not found it necessary to inject funds into their banking system. But I believe they've had some financial problems with some of their corporations over there.
Well, look, it may help your readers to understand what it means, injection of funds by central banks.
Yeah, well, tell us what that means exactly.
All right, it's the real reason the Federal Reserve was established in the United States in 1913, I think it was, over a great deal of opposition. Or the reason for a central bank is that on the fractional reserve banking system, which is what exists everywhere, banks can have more depositors. The claims of depositors on the banks exceed the amount of cash the banks have because they have made loans. And so if a run happens on the bank, people say, oh, the bank's going to go bust, let's get our money out, and they all run down there. They make the bank go bust because it doesn't have the cash. It's lent out. It has to then start calling the loans. And, of course, the loans are in various degrees of liquidity. You know, if somebody is in the middle of building a big plant, he hasn't got the money to give the bank back. At the same time, the plant's not operating, so he's not making goods to sell. And so the whole thing goes collapse. And so the whole point of the central bank is supposed to be there as a lender of last resort. So if demands are put on banks for cash they don't have, the central bank simply buys whatever loans are on the bank's books. It doesn't worry about whether they're good or bad. It just says, okay, give us those loans that aren't liquid right now, and here's some cash.
Yes.
And so when in these recent days some of these subprime derivatives have gone bad and banks hold them, and it affects their balance sheet, you know, are their assets equal to their liabilities? And to keep that kind of problem from coming up, the central banks just buy those dubious assets, and they buy them simply by giving the bank, making a bookkeeping entry on the bank's account with the central bank. They just say, okay, just to use an example, I don't mean to say anything. Well, this is a bank X. Okay, bank X, we've got your questionable securities, and you've now got X million dollars in your account with us. So the central bank can create money just by making a bookkeeping entry. It doesn't have to go print the dollars.
So that's the real power of money creation right there, isn't
it? That's it, right?
That's really the power of money creation when a centralized system there can say you have $10 billion more on your books of credit.
Right.
So it's credit creation. Let me ask you this.
It's credit creation, George, in order to prevent banking failures or financial failures. So it has a point to it, yeah.
Yeah, let me ask you this. It was reported earlier last week that there was over $300 billion injected into different central banks throughout the world. Is this an unprecedented amount of liquidity being created?
It could be. I just don't know. I couldn't really answer that.
So, I mean, does that give credence to this, that this thing is a worldwide financial crunch?
Well, George, these derivatives are marketed everywhere.
Okay, we're going to be back in a second. I'd like to ask you some more about these derivatives in a second. We'll be right back. Thank you, Doctor.
Okay.
Welcome back to World Review Commentary. I'm your host, George Butler. And this morning we have Paul Craig Roberts, and he's giving us an insight into this world financial crisis. Welcome back, Paul.
Thanks, George.
I had a question right before we left on that, before that last break. The derivatives market, could this be a can of worms? I mean, a really problem worldwide? I mean, the derivatives has just exploded into trillions of dollars. Does everyone know the relationships of all of these derivatives in those contracts? Does anyone have a handle on that?
I don't think so. You see, look, George, I'm not an expert on this. I'm not an investment banker. I don't spend my life studying these assets. But I think it's correct that most of these instruments have never been valued in the markets. They've been created by, say, investment banks, for example. And they're given a credit rating, which may or may not be accurate. And then the people who've created these instruments then call up pension funds and investors and central banks and all that, say, look, we've got all these things, and they're paying this high rate of interest, and you ought to buy some of them. And so that's how they're sold. It's not like that they're auctioned or that there's a market where many of them have been traded. And recently that was the trouble with the two Bear Stearns funds, the hedge funds that were full of these subprime derivatives, apparently. There wasn't any market for them, and they went to market them. The price was so low, the firms failed. So to answer your question, no, the value of these things is not really known. And also, it's not really known what their overall composition is. Many of these derivatives, George, as I understand it, there will be a combination of subprime loans with good mortgage loans, with auto loans, with consumer credit loans. You see what I'm saying?
It's so they're packaging these things in a lot of different ways,
well,
right?
They take all those things and put them in one instrument. And then you've bought something, and what you bought is you've bought some share of some subprime loan, some regular mortgage loan, some car loan, some consumer credit. You don't know anything about the individual loans that you own some piece of in the instrument that you have. And any of those things could go belly up, in which case the price of that instrument, that derivative you hold, would go down. And so nobody really knows what these things are worth. You can't say, oh, well, we can get an estimate from the real estate market, because you got different kinds of mortgages in there, different kinds of borrowers.
Yeah, it's hard to make an assessment of the value of these instruments and these assets within those. There was a recent experience. Bloomberg had a case over in Italy, Piera Levo and her husband. They run a 15-employee plumbing supply company. This is to bring it down on the personal level here, okay?
Right.
They bought one of these derivatives, and 6 years later, they paid 85,000 euros, or they lost about 117,000 to extricate themselves from a derivative known as an interest rate swap. So this was an example there of some personal individual here in business, in a plumbing business in Italy, losing $117,000 because maybe they weren't really knowledgeable about the risk involved in some of these instruments.
That's right. I don't think anybody really is knowledgeable about it. And that's sort of the problem that we face.
But well, that's why,
George, if the central banks do their job, they'll just monetize all these things.
They'll just keep pumping in money over $300 billion like they did this last week.
The central bank will end up owning all the bad ones, and so everybody gets bailed out, but at the expense of massive liquidity injected into the Western banking system.
Well, then
that
may
inflation. The world banking system. Yeah. So you get pressure on prices.
So inflationary, it would be highly inflationary, of course.
It seems to me it would, yep.
Because you have a lot more credits out there than you have goods, so it's just going to create, a lot more currency than goods, so it's just going to increase the value of the pricing of things. Does that sound right?
That's right. In other words, the way they can prevent the financial downside of these things going bad is the central banks buy them and then create new money with which to replace them. And therefore, you can see it would be inflationary.
Do you think the policies of this existing administration have been very detrimental to our economic well-being, or what?
Disastrous.
The neocons have been the primary policymakers in this administration.
yes, but it doesn't mean economic policy. It just means there hasn't been any economic policy because the neocons are focused entirely on war. And spending on war, so they're full of hubris and they have no economic training. They're basically, in my opinion, idiots and dangerous idiots.
So you're saying we had before the Iraq War, we had a trade imbalance that was not good, and then that was exacerbated by this Iraqi War. Would that be a fair assessment?
Yes, that's absolutely correct. Yeah.
And they're spending money like there's no end to it, but there is an end. What finally will happen, you think, with all this debt that's played? Will it transform this country into a debtor slave state or what? Where are we headed, really?
You mean the financial aspect?
Yes, the financial aspect.
Okay, I think it's not too late to do something. If we could get an administration that wasn't caught up in all this make-believe about terrorism, the need to fight terrorism, which they say means the need to invade all these Middle Eastern countries, which is just a bunch of crap. If we could get an intelligent administration in there, they could probably save the dollar as reserve currency. What they would have to do is, first of all, they'd have to get the budget, the government's budget in balance. They'd have to simply stop financing themselves with the issue of new debt. Just by doing that, it would give reassurance to many of the holders of all these dollars we've pumped out these decades. So that would be one step, and that could be done. Obviously, stopping the war, which is costing us a huge sum of money, would itself put the budget in balance. So, and then the next thing they would have to do, they would have to address this offshoring problem, because you can't forever consume more foreign goods than you can sell them your goods to pay for. And since when you offshore your goods, you're not making anything to sell them here, you see, to pay for what you're bringing back in.
So, exactly.
So you have to then find some way to address this offshoring, whether you do it by shaming the corporations publicly, where the president goes and uses his bully puppet and say, look, America, among all the countries of the world, is the only one whose companies don't give a flying crap about the American population, whether they have any jobs or income. And so either we're going to put on 100% tax on all income of CEOs over $1 million a year, or we're going to put a wage equalization tariff so that whatever you gain by giving an American job to a foreigner, you're going to give back to us in a tariff when you bring those goods produced abroad back to America. Those things would stop the offshoring. And the most dangerous thing, George, about the offshoring is not really everything we've talked about what's happening to the dollar and the potential effect on interest rates and so on. The most dangerous thing is that what offshoring does is it dismantles the ladders of upward mobility that have always made the United States an opportunity society, a place where people could rise. And the fact that people could always rise, even from the lowest orders, has made political stability in the United States. That is the reason for political stability, and that is the reason the vast income differences are tolerated, because people have always known that there's a chance for anybody with a bit of intelligence, drive, and good luck to make it. And so when you dismantle those ladders of upward mobility, you polarize a society. You get a few super rich and everyone else is poor. They're destroying the middle class. And then the result of this dismantling the ladders of upward mobility is going to be political turmoil. People are not going to continue to tolerate this conspicuous consumption we see everywhere, these income differences. And the political stability of the United States is being destroyed by offshoring.
I've got you. Can you hang on to the next hour with us?
George, I really can't.
You can't?
No, I enjoyed talking to you, and I appreciate you sharing your audience with me.
Well, Dr. Roberts, you really gave us some good insights on this program, and this is our premier program. We certainly thank you for being on it. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you for your interest.
Thank you, sir.
All the best.
Okay, thank you.